From the EWTN radio and television studios, this is EWTN Theology Roundtable, a conversation with the experts of EWTN's Department of Theology. Got questions about the liturgy, scripture, or tradition? They have the answers. Now, EWTN Theology Roundtable.
So glad that you're here joining us on this very special broadcast of EWTN Theology Roundtable, coming to you live on EWTN Radio and on television as well, coming to you from Radio Studio One in our headquarters, world headquarters in Irondale, Alabama, here for EWTN on Mother Angelica Way. I'm Elena Rodriguez. So glad again that you can join us. The Lord has you here for a reason. The Lord has all of us here for a reason. And we want to welcome our theology team that will be with us for the remainder of the hour with you as well, because we want to invite you to participate, and I'll give you that phone number in just a moment. First, of course, we have our host, who is Colin Donovan. He is the Vice President of Theology here at EWTN. Colin, a delight to have you here.
Good to be here as always, Elena.
And also our theology advisors, Laura Dittus. Laura, welcome.
Thank you.
And Noah Lett.
Hey, Elena.
Welcome to you as well. And maybe this thought has occurred to you in the past. You've had this thought, what in the world is wrong with this world? It looks like good is evil, and then evil is good, and you scratch your head, and you try to stir people in the right direction, and you share your thoughts, and everybody looks at you like you're from another planet, like you're crazy. What is going on? So to answer that question, we have our theologians here, and this is a very interesting topic. I want you to think about questions and share them with us. I'll give you the number in just a moment. Utopias, dystopias, and the future. And what does that mean? That's why we have our theologians here. But you can ask your questions by calling 1-800-585-9396. That number again is 1-800-585-9396. And our call screener, Michael McCall, is ready to take your call. You can also join us on YouTube, our YouTube webcast, live webcast, and Facebook as well, by going to Facebook, our EWTN radio page on Facebook, and you can watch the video, and you can also chime in with questions on the chat. Likewise, on YouTube, you can go to youtube.com and type in the search bar EWTN, and then you'll go to our EWTN channel, and you'll see the live webcast there. And Mr. Jeff Burson, nice person, is handling the social media, and it is true he's a nice person, so you can chime in with questions as well. And Colin, help us out here. What is going on with the world? Utopias, dystopias, and what is in the future for us?
It's enough to make your head swim, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
I'm already dizzy here.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of people today are motivated by an idea that we can have a perfect world. We don't need any help in that. We just need to. Science, technology, culture will make this always moving forward progress, and eventually we'll end up with a perfect world. Mm-hmm. This is the utopian idea, and it motivates a lot of people. Now, we can distinguish that, I think, also from idealism. We should all have an idealism about being just to others and having a more just society. But this goes beyond that to the idea that really we can build a perfect world without God, just with science, technology, by law, and by societal structures, and that's all we have to do. So that's the utopian side of the question. The dystopian side of the question, of course, is there's a good deal of what you might call apocalypticism, both in the church and outside of it today, you know, as if the world is going to hell in a handbasket and everything is falling apart and the future only holds disaster. Well, that's the dystopian view. And we find both of those in people's thinking, and people can go back and forth between the one and the other. The church, of course, doesn't necessarily follow that view, and it rejects some of the efforts, certainly in human history, which would, you could say, are utopian, like communism. Marx and Engels wanted to build such a perfectly just society. Or Hitler, under his own perspectives, wanting to have a 1,000-year Reich of National Socialism. This would be an example. Or capitalists, some capitalists who think that simply if we let the free market reign and do its thing, we'll have a economically just society. Or today we have very popularly the racial and gender ideology utopians who feel that that all we need to do is everybody gets to be themselves and leave everybody else alone. But generally, in the end, they don't want to leave anybody alone. They want them to adopt and to take their views. So this is the utopian idea. We also find a certain amount of religious utopianism, both in the Catholic Church and outside the Church, particularly in what has been traditionally called millenarianism, the idea that Christ will come and reign on the earth in a thousand years, a sort of paradisical situation. And the Catechism gives short, you know, putting away or short shrift to all of these ideas, beginning at paragraph 676 and then in 677. It associates it with the ongoing Antichrist spirit, which will someday manifest itself in a personal Antichrist, by saying that the Antichrist deception already begins to take shape in the world every time the claim is made to realize within history the messianic hope, which can only be realized beyond history through the eschatological judgment. In other words, through the last judgment and through eternity and the new heavens and the new earth. The Church rejects even modified forms of this falsification of the kingdom to come under the name of millenarianism, so the religious perspective of that, but especially the intrinsically perverse political form of secular messianism. And I think that's what we see more and more in the political and cultural world today, this utopian secular idea that that people have. So I think the world is left hanging between sort of presumption that we can build such a world on one hand and despair that things are all going to go bad and we'll never get out of the morass that we're in. And we find both of these, I think, in the last century, in particular in literature and culture in different forms, mm-hmm. where people have taken these ideas, not necessarily embracing them, often with being very critical of utopian ideas.
Yeah. If one were to ask what are sources of utopian ideas, we have no farther to look than, say, science fiction as a primary source of things. We all know how science seemed to seduce us by promises that by just the proper application of scientific method and logic to policies in society, we can eliminate war, we can eliminate poverty, we can eliminate ignorance, we can eliminate crime, and it seemed like it was going to happen. And so science fiction novels, which is fiction, and fiction always begins with a what if, they created worlds in which they say, what if it were the case that poverty was eliminated, or we had a way of eliminating ignorance by putting some drug in the water and people drink it? We can all remember the original Star Trek series, where in there every now and then they ran into a world that was a paradise, or the Federation itself was often shown, especially in The Next Generation, as a place where they'd eliminated war and poverty and ignorance and want within the Federation itself. There were earlier novels that people might not think of as paradise-oriented, and that would be H.G. Wells's novels like The Time Machine, or one called Her Land, which I think was published in 1917. It stars a group of women, it sounds like a movie that's out there now, living on an isolated island who reproduce asexually, but whose society is a paradise, you know. And there are no men, of course, in this society. One thinks about that island that this Wonder Woman person comes from. Anyway, the point is not that you need to stop saying what if, but it's that you create what ifs. And, of course, all these novels, these science fiction ones, rarely ever have any religion in them. It's rarely the case that religion is brought in as a help to achieve removal of poverty and so forth. Often it's shown as an obstacle. And so we have to remember that the desire to get rid of poverty and want and those sort of things are very good, but to think that we can actually remove it entirely, and this is important, the key idea here, as the Catechism gives us, is that we must put restraints on the Church in order to be able to achieve this. So the Church has to include church insurance companies have to include the option for abortion for women in coverage. That's a removal of the Church's power to say the truth, you know. Mm-hmm. Or one can think about the idea that we can have a better society if we only limit religion to worship in the buildings rather than have it be the case that you can have religion, you know, which would they defined as being out in society. We have to remember that even in science fiction novels, science can be misrepresented, but it's always the case that religion and philosophy are. I want to mention two other works here. Michael O'Brien, who's written a science fiction novel called Voyage to Alpha Centauri.
Now, he's a Catholic author who writes from a Catholic perspective.
And in there, he has, like Star Trek Enterprise, on board the Enterprise, it was paradise, more or less, right? It reflected the Federation's ability to conquer these perennial human problems. Well, he starts with a paradise spaceship, and he shows how it declines into this ruinous society because of the strict application of scientism to the lives of people on board the ship. And a final one is C.S. Lewis wrote a series of space trilogy novels, and the last one is entitled, is entitled That Hideous Strength, in which he actually looks at what happens to society when you apply this scientism in a very strict way. And it's pretty enlightening to read it. And the final point to make about all this is, what if is not dangerous? What is dangerous is for people to think it's to overlook what the church teaches us. And I think that's what Laura's going to talk to us about.
Yeah, and I think, you could have mentioned as well, I think that among the more critical things of Utopia, there is the work, say, of Aldous Huxley or of George Orwell, both of who were critical of totalitarian systems as they saw them in their day, in which, of course, the Soviet Union is no longer with it, but there's plenty of totalitarian-minded governments out there today. And so the idea of presenting utopias is very often in order to show that humanly we're flawed and they're going to fall apart on some grounds.
Yeah.
But as you previewed a little bit, the church does have an answer.
Sure.
And there is a reason why we turn to the church and to the catechism to find out what that answer is.
So I guess answering the question of how do we respond to utopias and dystopias being presented, we look at what the church has to say in terms of the truth about man, the truth about social structures, and about our need for a redeemer. So this grand society isn't going to come from man alone. Again, there's some action steps here, too. We can practice the virtue of hope, participate in society. We're not called to run to the hills. And then also to keep a supernatural vision. The first one, the truth about man. Man is created with freedom, and he's to find his perfection through the gift of self to God and others. Just a simply material paradise is never going to fulfill man, because man is called to love. John Paul II talks about this in Dives and Misericordia, paragraph 41. He says, "Man cannot give himself to a purely human plan for reality, an abstract ideal, or a false utopia. As a person, he can give himself to another person or to other persons, and ultimately to God." And then he says, "A society is alienated if its forms of social organization, production and consumption make it more difficult to offer this gift of self and to establish the solidarity between people." So we have to see man's fallen, but at the same time, he's got a redeemer. We have to see this desire for paradise along these lines.
And he's talking about having ways to assist man to love, to deal, to be in communion with others, as opposed to sort of technologically or scientifically constrain his behavior by just simply a material prosperity or something of that
way. One can think of the 1984, the society was thought to be something that could be made more perfect if the government could spy on everybody, right? And so they took away man's privacy, they took away man's freedoms in other way, all because they thought by surveillance in your room, there was, this thing that would look at you. Government could dial into anybody's house and see what you were doing.
Or Fahrenheit 451, controlling what you read, as if controlling what you read would restrain the human spirit from thinking and having ideas and wanting to go beyond itself. Well, let's pick that up again when we get back from our break, and we'll look at the questions in which are the ways in which the church says we can appropriately respond to the problems of individuals and of cultures.
That's right. What do we do? You've got three experts here: Colin Donovan, Noah Lett, and Laura Dittes. The number to call with your question, 1-800-585-9396. Perhaps someone has approached you in church or maybe in a classroom or at a workplace. What do you answer? 1-800-585-9396. More of EWTN Theology Roundtable coming right up. Stay tuned.
Be touched by the sacredness of the Most Blessed Sacrament, the resting place of Mother Angelica, plus tour the EWTN campus. Start your Catholic pilgrimage today with EWTN. Call 205-271-2966.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 6, verses 48 to 58. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, and they died. This is the bread," meaning me. "This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat of it and never die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh." At which the Jews disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" They're scandalized by this. How is it that we're not? How is it that we just hear this and go, "Oh yeah, I know that passage"? They're just outraged and at least perplexed. Sane people, inspired teachers, wise men, prophets don't say things like this.
This is Janet Benkovic, host of Women of Grace.
Hello, this is Cardinal Donald Wuerl of the Archdiocese of Washington.
This is Gloria Purvis, host of Morning Glory. Thanks for listening to the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Welcome back to EWTN Theology Roundtable on EWTN Radio and Television. Join our conversation with your question or comment. Call us toll-free. 1-800-585-9396. Outside the United States and Canada, call 1-205-271-2985 or send us an email, etr@ewtn.com.
That's right. Our lines are open here on EWTN Theology Roundtable here on EWTN. And what do you say when somebody maybe proposes, "Oh, let's bring back communism. It's a good thing we should revisit"? Well, you have a panel of experts here. Is that a utopia? Is that a dystopia? Or is it both? Colin Donovan, our Vice President of Theology, here with us, along with theology advisors Noah Lett and Laura Dittus. There's an innumerable amount of questions, Colin, that we can present here, but the main thing is we need to know how to answer this. What is the real answer?
That's right, and I think if our listeners, you know, sort of look at the landscape around them, they probably will have some questions that fit into this, you know, who is presenting utopian ideas, which are likely to lead to a dystopian kind of future in which is inhuman and so on and so forth.
Let me remind our callers that our lines are open and this would be a good time to call so you can get your question in on time. The number is 1-800-585-9396. That number again is 1-800-585-9396. Or if you prefer, you can also send us an email at ETR, which stands for EWTN Theology Roundtable. Again, that's ETR@EWTN.com. Colin, the answer man.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Laura, you were talking about alienation and how important it is to have the church's view of this. We should have a life oriented to love and communion of others. And that builds the kind of society that we want to live in, as opposed to, you know, inhuman futures or utopian futures which don't have any real place to go.
Right. And of course we want things like technological progress and things like that. It's not that any of us want to get rid of our computers things like that. But
or stop watching Star Trek movies or using our iPhones.
Yeah. But at the same time, that doesn't speak to the whole of man. Man is a spiritual person. And so if all we're aiming for is material goods or financial welfare, then we're aiming too low. And so the church also has something to say about social structures, that those won't be enough to bring about a utopia either. And on this point, I bring in Pope Benedict Spes Salvi, which is a document on Christian hope, paragraph 24. And he says, "The right state of human affairs, the moral well-being of the world, can never be guaranteed simply through structures alone, however good they are. Such structures are not only important, but necessary. they cannot, yet they cannot and must not marginalize human freedom. So he's not saying get rid of structures or or don't try to have good structures, but he's saying that's not enough. You need to keep in mind the human person as a whole that man is called to love. And then also paragraph 25, he says good structures help, but of themselves they are not enough. Man can never be redeemed simply from outside. So we need a redeemer. And then looking at the question a little bit more broadly, you know, what do we do about the future? The Catechism, paragraph 2115, says God can reveal the future to his prophets or to other saints. Still, a sound Christian attitude consists in putting oneself confidently into the hands of providence for whatever concerns the future. So, yeah, we always have to keep in mind God's in the boat. God's God's with us in the storm, and at the same time to engage our culture too.
Yeah, and without doing those things, we're never going to make any kinds of progress. I think it's what the church is opposed to, the idea that any progress we make can ultimately be a kind of earthly perfection. And so whether it's to, you know, love our neighbor, well, our neighbor may hate us in return. If it's to build a good social system, human nature tends to undermine every social system and every method that's, for instance, that's been created to relieve poverty. You know, if it doesn't have incentives, then to work, people will not work. If it if it has incentives to work, then for some people, the safety net is not sufficient for them. So there are always going to be human judgments and moral judgments about the sufficiency of the structures that we have. No structure can be perfect.
A typical example brought up about the importance of the church. The church is not here calling for a policy to attack ideas to improve the earth. The church is calling us to recognize in ourselves a certain kind of thing we can seem to never get rid of. You know, blessed is the person who, after trying certain policies, doesn't think they need more power to strong arm people to do the right thing. Think of Mother Teresa's nuns. There they are out there day after day taking care of a problem that seems to never end. And they don't become, they don't have despair. They don't ask for power to coerce people, the rich, to give up their money. But you look at typical social workers in many countries that don't practice the hope and love and faith of Mother Teresa's order. They burn out. Because they look and say, nothing's going to help this problem, you know, or maybe I need more power to coerce people. You know, come to yourself, the church says, think about yourself and where you are, and realize that there has to be another way than coercion by power or by drugs or giving up hope.
Right. And I think the essence of utopianism is somehow presented also in the parable of the man who built all the barns, thinking, my barns are full and now I have, you know, I'm satisfied. And that night his life was demanded of him.
Yeah.
Because we forget how contingent we are. We are not infinite creatures. We're contingent on the future, on God, on each other. And so when we act as if we aren't contingent, that we're morally autonomous and that we're autonomous in every way, there's usually the fly in the ointment is our human nature, which is defective. And we'll eventually find that out.
You can chime in with your questions. 1-800-585-9396. Maybe somebody has suggested to you we should only love and let love take care of its of everything else. And you go, well, is that realistic? How do you answer that question? Our panel of experts right here for you, 1-800-585-9396. That's the number that Pam called in Nebraska. She's listening to us through Spirit Catholic Radio. Pam, go ahead with your question, please.
Well, my question is, can you hear me?
Very well.
My question is that I'm from the West Coast, and I live in Nebraska now, and my family has become so hostile that you can't even talk to them. You can't use any reason or facts or logic. They just are just ready to attack. It's like almost they're waiting for you to come into the room so they can all jump on you.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, I would like to be able to offer them a book or to talk to them, you know, about our faith and about in the way we feel about, you know, why we're against abortion and why we're against same-sex marriage, but it just is so hostile. It's almost like they don't even want to listen to the facts.
Well, and this, I think, comes from the utopian idea, you know, that if you're not prepared to accept a morality and a moral norm that's given to you, you invent your own. And then in your own mind, of course, anything we invent is perfect. Mm-hmm. And that's the utopianism. And the perfect needs to be accepted by everybody. There was an article the other day in a Catholic entity. It might have been one of EWTN's. I forget exactly which one. Maybe it was Church Pop or CNA or National Catholic Register, about the end of argumentation, that today people are not willing to argue. They simply, you know, assert the truth of something. They're not prepared to have a discourse and argument. That's actually a very bad sign, because I think, as you've discovered, it's hard to convince people if they're not even ready to dialogue with you.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, sometimes the first piece of conversation is not going to be abortion or any of the hot topic issues. A lot of times it's just being a friend to your family and then seeing where the Lord allows you to go with that.
And remembering it takes grace, and he'll have to do that part of it.
Yeah.
But it's good to think, and it's good to understand. And we continue with more of EWTN Theology Roundtable here with Paul and Donovan, Noah Lett, and Laura Dittus in just a moment. 1-800-585-9396. Call in, be a part of the show. Stay tuned.
Peggy Normandin. I was really pretty vain in my mid-20s. I was consumed with all those, you know, superficial trappings in life. Well, during this time, I had a dream where my grandmother appeared to me. She was a very loving, plain, modest woman of great faith. Well, in the dream, she was absolutely radiant. And she said, "This is what I look like now. Everything is perfect in heaven, Peggy. This is all that matters." What a powerful spiritual wake-up call that was.
Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin. Saturdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
And this is an EWTN Bookmark Brief. I'm Doug Keck. I just finished interviewing Father Maurice Emlu about his book, Our Journey to God, published by EWTN. Tell us about it. It's also subtitled, An African Priest Explores the Power of Faith from Abraham to You. As best you can, give us a short synopsis of this work.
It really walks you through from the actual objective dimension of revelation, the nature of faith, to the living the life of faith itself, the real aspect of living the life. And it walks the two arms and brings them together. Is a blend of both cultures with unique African stories and biblical stories and Western stories, and is a dialogue of faith in a positive way.
Right, and insights from both cultures.
Yes.
Father Maurice, the book Our Journey to God, published by EWTN, available through our catalog. Of course, check it out. Check out the entire interview coming soon to EWTN. And I'm Doug Keck, and this has been a Bookmark Brief.
The EWTN home video highlight for June is My Time with Jesus, Fatima. It's an adventure in virtue and heroic sacrifice as the children of Fatima show how we too can be holy. Order your DVD collection of all 5 episodes at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Or call 1-800-854-6316. Welcome back to EWTN Theology Roundtable on EWTN Radio and Television. Join our conversation with your question or comment. Call us toll-free. 1-800-585-9396. Outside the United States and Canada, call 1-205-271-2985 or send us an email, etr@ewtn.com.
That's right. We are checking our email as well. If you want to email us a question for Colin Donovan, Noah Lett, Laura Dittus, our theologians today here on EWTN Theology Roundtable, we are talking about utopias, dystopias, and the future. What in the world is going on? And what do we say to people who bring about ideas that, when you really measure them, there's no way to really apply them to reality, and they're missing out a lot of arguments? What do you say? This is why we have our panel of experts. The number is 1-800-585-9396. That number again is 1-800-585-9396. And by the way, if you're tuning in on EWTN Radio as this show is going live right now, if you want to see Colin and Noah and Laura, you can tune in on Sunday, June 18th and watch it on EWTN Television then. That would be at 10 p.m. Eastern. So maybe after dinner, gather the family together Sunday, June 18th. And it's also going to be Father's Day that day. So our greetings to fathers ahead of time, and may God bless you, and thank you for responding your call to be a father. So also all of our spiritual fathers and our priests, happy Father's Day as well. It is very important. It is very important to understand what to say. And Colin, we have a good question from Richard, our friend on Facebook. He says, is it the role of utopianism to throw idealism at a real problem, such as those I've heard say, we only need to love? And he's heard this being said in the face of recent terror attacks. What can Richard share with people who tell him this?
I think it's a misunderstanding of love to think that we surrender to evil. Mm-hmm. Our Lord didn't ask us to do that. We have a right to turn the other cheek as individuals. Mm-hmm. But in our society, a father, a governor, a president, a monarch, prime minister, whoever, they have a responsibility for people. And love doesn't mean simply peace, kisses, hugs, and all of that. It means to will the good of the other, to will the good of the terrorists, and that would be that they're converted. We pray for them. To at least will that the terrorists do no more harm and damage to others, and to take the prudent steps to make that happen. That's love for the members of the society we're responsible for, whether it's our family or a nation or Western civilization. So I think you have to have a proper understanding of what love is.
I take this question and expand it a little bit. You know, if you take the view that the only reason why the terrorists are attacking us is because they lack economic opportunity or because they don't have enough education, and you think all we got to do is throw that at them and they will stop.
Which is used, or that, well, it's our fault. We've created a hostile environment for them, hostile world.
And so you think we just give them, you know, this harbor or that thing. Well, that view of the person is an ignorant view of the person. There are people out there who say, like the Islamic terrorist, you know, we just don't want you. We want you to be a Muslim. That's what we want. I don't want your money. You know, I don't want your harbor. I want you to be a Muslim. I want you to live under Sharia law. That is not on that list of the original things that people say. You know, these are we called them liberal-minded people that thought all that you needed to have to make a better world was education and economic opportunity to people. This is where the church calls upon us to be educated by our own humanity, to see that just because someone offers us those list of things doesn't mean that we necessarily become a perfect person, or that our ideas, that our motivations for revenge will stop.
The idea of love is usually put out by the utopian or the idealist who has this sort of sky-high notion of what love can accomplish. We have a sky-high notion of what love can accomplish. It's called God. But if you think what human love can accomplish, it won't do it. There is what's called prudence, and every act of love should be a prudent. And Aquinas has 8 parts to prudence. Looking around to see the circumstances, thinking ahead to seeing the obstacles that that loving will bring about, or the obstacles to accomplishment, to take into account all of the different aspects of a question. So love done in a prudent way to bring about the real end which you want, which would be the conversion and safety not only of the life of the terrorists, but also of the safety of the people whom you're responsible for. That requires prudent action and thinking, and it may require using force to stop that. I remember the Pope being one of the first in the world to even suggest that ISIS should be stopped. Yes. He didn't say killed. He said stop, but that's a way of saying whatever proportionally is needed, whatever prudentially is needed. And that's love for the neighbor, love for the person who would be the object of hatred of the terrorist.
Yes. And it, absolutely, it, requires prudence. I mean, if someone comes to your door, you're not going to just hand them flowers. You know, if they're coming in a threatening way, you have to respond accordingly. And it wouldn't be a loving act of a father to not take care of his household if a household's threatened.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, very good. We have good questions coming in from our listeners. We're going to go to Bill first. I want to remind you, our number, 1-800-585-9396. This is a good time to call before the lines are completely full. 1-800-585-9396. We are talking about utopias, dystopias, and the future. What do you say to people when they challenge your views, your ideas? And maybe when they even cut you short in the sentence and they don't let you finish expressing your view of faith or out in the public square. Here are Colin Donovan, Noah Lett, and Laura Dittes to answer that question. And Bill is listening in Virginia, and he's listening through the John Paul the Great Radio. Bill, welcome, and what is your question? Go right ahead.
Earlier you had referred to the person as a spiritual being. And I had heard recently, or read recently, that the spirit refers to the powers of the soul, for example, the intellect and the will.
Correct.
And I had also read recently, just in the last couple of days, about the idea of person as in relation to another. And what I wanted to know would be if that relation of the person from one to another, if that could be defined as love as well, is what you were speaking of previously. And then how might that be, employed,
sure,
for lack of a better word, for society?
No, I think all of those are good. The trouble would be convincing people of them. You know, there's an ancient philosophical definition of person, an individual substance of a rational nature. That definition applies to God, who is a divine being, has a rational nature, the angels, who as a spiritual being has a rational nature, and to man, who as a material and spiritual being has a rational nature. So the definition of a person would definitely help society. Now, we understand as Christians, of course, that as part of the nature of God is this love among the persons of the Trinity, and that certainly comes into our human definition of building a just society, a good society, because love is certainly in the going out of oneself, rather than going in oneself in a kind of moral autonomy and not in need of others, and a radical individuality. Both of those things are rampant today. So the trouble is getting people to accept those things as true, I think.
Sure, and just even seeing the person as a relational being is a start, too. A lot of times people they think of their own good, but at the same time, we are in society and we're called to solidarity and to bearing each other's, loving others in society as well. And so seeing man as a whole, as a person with an intellect and a will, I mean, that's really the only way that we're going to be able to do justice to the human person. Otherwise, all we're going to take care of are his material needs. And, you know, someone who has all the material resources in the world, I mean, that's not enough for their happiness. So,
yeah, I would think that he used the word employ this to help with the problems. I think that one of the important ways you relate to a person as a person is to tell them the gospel of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. You are a person for whom Christ died. That this helps you and them to understand that it's not your standard for what a person is, and it's not the speaker's standard, it's Christ's standard. He died for persons. And so by telling an individual the gospel, you can get involved in seeing them as a whole person. As, for example, if you lived before the Civil War, you might have wanted to tell the gospel to one of the slaves. And then you had to maybe run into the problem with the government saying they're not a full person, but there they are in front of you. And maybe you start talking about Jesus Christ, and they listen. There's a sign that they're a person. And then you have to deal with what you were taught that was wrong in the face of what Jesus is teaching you by your sharing the gospel with this person that maybe other people didn't think about doing so because they didn't think they weren't persons.
They weren't worth it.
Yes.
They weren't worth it. You know, it's such a different standard, and it's the right standard. If you look at the you know, if you rely on a utopian idea, and there are many of them, we've talked about the economic, the communist, the socialist, we've talked even about the certain forms of capitalism which are entirely free and this is the way to distribute goods. It's a method, true, but it's not a perfect method because human beings are not perfect. So you look, take a look at any system, you're going to have that foible. The trouble is when you have a purely utopian viewpoint, is very often it gets down to what benefits me and having everything revolve around me, and then you lose this communitarian, you lose this idea of love diffusing from within individuals in the family, from the family and society, from between societies and others, and so on, and you lose that idea if everything becomes a focus on me. That I'm to be respected because I'm me. That I'm to be respected because I'm white or black,
yes.
Or male or female, mm-hmm. Or gay or lesbian or transgender or one of the other 66 genders. If that is the reason that you deserve respect, ultimately, in order to get that respect, you're going to force others to do something that is not respectful. Mm-hmm. And that's why that kind of individualism is not... does not build societies of that have communion and love and real dignity as a society built on knowing that we are children of God and loved by God and redeemed by Christ. That builds such communities.
Yes.
Trevor is listening and following the show through Facebook, and Trevor is asking, do you think the idea of godly utopia has affected the way that churches' outer forms look, like in the case of vestments during Mass, the way they dress, aesthetics?
I think absolutely. In this way. But it's not pointing to utopia on earth. What's it pointing to? It's pointing to heaven. Celibacy for the sake of the kingdom of God, as Christ speaks in Matthew 19. For the sake of the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. The vestments is a reflection of the worship in heaven that we see in John in the book of Revelation. So yes, they do, but to keep our mind fixed on the vision of heaven, not on this world. Yeah. It's a sacred place, it's a sacred space, it's a sacred time, and that's to draw us specifically out of the world into the next world progressively, and then someday we actually get there.
Yeah, I would caution that the word utopia tends to talk about those worlds where things are made perfect by human application alone. What if humans did this or didn't do that? The church's vestments point to a world that's to come, that's already partially with us, evident through worship of God. And so, yes, when you see the colors of the vestments, you see the different things on the altar, you should be thinking not of some government policy, but of what Jesus has done for you and what's coming, you know, when he returns.
And also to remember, if we're speaking of heaven in terms of a utopia, it would be in the sense of a good place rather than a place that doesn't exist, because originally the word utopia meant no place. Yeah. Heaven is a place.
That's right. And it's the place, as Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 13, where everything else, faith and hope go away, but there's love.
Yes.
And that's the thing that survives. And that's, we have that here on earth as well. Yeah. And we can work towards that ultimate end.
We want to see all of you in heaven. So stay tuned and listen to EWTN, and that'll give you a pathway to get there. And prayer, lots of prayer. But before you do that, you can call in the show as well. 1-800-585-9396. That number again, 1-800-585-9396. And Chuck is listening to EWTN through St. Gabriel Radio right there in Columbus, Ohio. Chuck, your question for Colin Donovan, Noah Lett, and Laura Dittes. Go right ahead.
Hello, everybody. Thanks
Hello.
For taking my call.
Sure, Chuck.
The church has made, you know, certain pronouncements or statements of a very earthly nature about economic policy, you know, living wage, that sort of thing. And I understand that picture goes back to at least like 1958 as a promulgated teaching of the church, but even more recently, the Holy Father's statements about, you know, the border and making remarks about border security with regard to President Trump's policy have a very sector specific, policy specific aspect to them that I find more consistent with the utopian frame of mind than with the strictly spiritual line that the church, mm-hmm. I feel, should be giving and or taking. And I just want to know what your thoughts are. How do you deconflict these very, to me, utopian-sounding policy-specific pronouncements by the Holy Father or just more generally by the church?
Well, I'll let somebody else take that initially, but I'll just point out that these social encyclical views go back to the 1800s. They're not as recent as the 1950s.
You do make a good point. These statements made by our bishops, there's a number of things to say. I'll say this. The statements made about economic policies, that a living wage, you should have a living wage, and maybe they actually endorse one or say some sort of minimum or something. It is the case that the Catholic individual has to judge whether the things that the trends or the organizations are getting involved with trying to achieve that are looking to build a world in which God is eventually absent, or whether they're looking to do it because they know Jesus is returning and they may see him sooner than that and be judged on whether they have taken care of those
whether
who are in jail and so forth. That's right. And so the bishop's comments are not always so particularized that it prevents a person from using their phrases for their own banner cry. Those people or trends who in the end actually do intend to have a world without God. So we should pay attention to the practical things they say and understand that the church must affect the way people live and the church must speak about these things. And sadly, they get used and taken over by people who don't mean good by them.
And yes, it is an ideal because it's talking about matters of justice, and justice has a norm. It's to give, render to each yes. according to their due. So there is a norm to justice. It's fulfilled, obviously, the justice is fulfilled by giving that due. Love is fulfilled by having directing, making sure that that is directed to the goal, which is God mm-hmm. in eternity, as Noah was saying. So I think it's the way we take them and understand it. If we take them as political slogans, we're taking them wrong. Yeah. If we take them as guidance for which we still have to use our prudential judgment regarding the means and how to accomplish justice yes. in this world, then we're on a solid track.
And also the church doesn't promote particular systems. The church promotes principles. And so these principles can be applied in a lot of different scenarios. And it's not promoting a certain utopian government or anything like that, but just seeing the human person and how we're to respond to the human person in society.
And I think this is the danger today, isn't it, Noah? With, for instance, the Pope's encyclical, their exhortation dealing with climate issues and all that. The principles of environmental stewardship in there are valid in season and out season. The conclusions, the scientific conclusions, the practical means to an end, and those things. These are things about which people can have a disagreement. And so the Pope himself says that in there, that this is not to be taken, you know, as limiting the right of the political authorities, which have the responsibility to make the application of these. But it needs to be taken by Catholics as moral guidance, as an objective to be shot for in the most practical way. And that is a multiple consideration judgment.
Yeah. That's an example we should take to mind. These comments about climate, stewardship of the climate, of the environment, we can see how difficult it is in this environment because those statements get taken over by the ecologist people, and they want to then have all the people in the church come on board their policies because they say, yeah, the Pope means what we mean. No, we have to be more thoughtful and say, no, the Pope doesn't mean what you mean. He means something else, so come and let's talk together about the other stuff that the Pope means.
Right. Talk about the teaching.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'll look for the scientists to have the other fights among themselves.
Yeah.
Maybe still time for you to call in. If you call in right now to get your question in with Colin Donovan, Noah Lett, and Laura Dittus, we are talking about utopias, dystopias, and the future here on EWTN Theology Roundtable. And we have Diane in Dallas, Texas. She is listening through Guadalupe Radio Network. Diane, your question, please go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you. I have question about some comments that I saw somebody making on Facebook. And so, does the world owe us love and respect, and is justice the means by which we show our love?
Mm-hmm. It owes every human being the love and respect for being the dignity of being a human being. Justice is certainly a way in which we show our love. It's the precondition for love. Mm-hmm. If we're not trying to render justice to others, we can't really say that we love them. Mm-hmm. We have to give, children have to show their parents, not just, you know, by being automatons who fulfill what their parents require of them, you know, wash your face before, you know, bed, wash your hands before meals, do this and that, and so on and so forth. By justice, they have to fulfill that. They have that duty. But they should have that duty infused with love and not with simply, well, they're bigger than I am and I'm going to be in trouble if they... So, yes, you can distinguish between justice and the love and the way that it works. They should both be present. Often or not, they're not.
And I think, too, justice is also tempered with mercy, too. So even in family life, if, say, someone breaks your window, you don't have to say, okay, son, you have to repay for this window. You know, it costs this much, and you're going to work until you repay it. You know, there's a kind of totality that we need to see as well. But absolutely, justice, understood rightly, is how we show love in community.
She used the word, the world owes me, and is justice the way we show our love? And I think Colin is exactly right. You know, that if we only showed people justice, my gosh, let me out of this world before it gets started, you know, because we have to show love and mercy. And love and mercy make distinctions that justice doesn't always allow. Mm. Because justice and mercy look toward an end that's different than the end that justice looks for. Love looks for giving the person the good they don't have that may help them to become, you know, St. Paul in the end, who becomes the apostle to the Gentiles, or St. Peter, who needs to be told three times, feed my sheep, you know. Love looks beyond what justice would demand and gives the person what they mm-hmm. need so that they might,
that's right.
in fact, become a more perfected for Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you take the whole scenario of the redemption. Mm-hmm. If justice was the thing, we would all be destined to hell and we would all end up in hell and yeah. we would be there forever. Yeah. But no, love brought the Lord down to redeem us. Love enables the church to dispense the grace of forgiveness in the sacrament of mm-hmm. reconciliation, to dispense further forgiveness for temporal faults through indulgence and through yeah. other ways. This is the exercising of mercy. If we simply had a world of justice, as you noted, mm-hmm. who would want to live in such yeah. a world? In many ways, this is the world of the devil, because the yeah. devil doesn't know mercy, but he knows law,
yeah.
and he will enforce the law. And exorcists have spoken about this, how that he is looking for the legal basis under which he has control of a person. And when we give him that legal basis, now he makes us dance his dance. We never want to do that, because he is a man of law. And the odd thing about the Antichrist, when he comes in the future at some hopefully long distance date, is that he will be the lawless one himself, but his law he will demand that we adhere to. And he will do so mercilessly. And this is ultimate kind of utopian world in which the lawgiver takes the place of God. And that's, we see that today, and we will someday see it, sadly, on a global scale.
We talked about fiction at the beginning, and they say, what if? For the movie buffs and adults out there, there's a movie called John Wick 2, which actually takes the point of view. What if we had a world in which all there was justice? Mm. And what would it be like? Mm. And man, it's diabolical, let me tell you.
It is. And let's hope we're not heading to that anytime soon.
Let's hope indeed. And very quickly, we have less than a minute left, but Liliana on Facebook is asking if war is moral.
Yes, war is moral to defend yourself against an aggressor. War is moral because you must defend the innocent from the strong.
It's what a society does. It's what a policeman does. It's what a parent does if they're protecting their child from yeah. a person who wishes to take that child's life.
And I want to thank the three of you for protecting our faith and steering us in the right direction. Colin Donovan, Laura Dittes, and Noah Led. God bless you for your efforts and all your preparation. And God bless all of our crew here at EWTN. I want to invite you to tune in next month for more of EWTN Theology Roundtable, coming to you live through EWTN Radio YouTube, Facebook, and also through EWTN Television. And again, a very, very warm greeting to all fathers out there, spiritual and physical. God bless you and stay true to God. This is Elena Rodriguez saying stand by until the next time.